scripture reading this evening. We continue our study in the life of Jacob, and we read in Genesis chapter 32 and from verse 22. You will remember that Jacob had managed to successfully, in his eyes at least, deceive his brother and his father of the birthright and the blessing. Life was getting a bit hot at home, and he had to leave home. He ran off to Uncle Laban in the north, a journey of some danger. He arrived there, stayed there 20 years working with his Uncle Laban, and discovered that Laban's household was really God's school of discipline, and he learned there a great deal. Strange lessons, necessary lessons. He was obliged to leave Laban in some haste. God had told him to return to the land of Canaan, and he had sought to do that again by his own cunning and prowess, rather than face Laban and tell him openly what he planned to do. Laban caught up with him. God prevented Laban from doing Jacob any harm. But nevertheless, a cairn, a boundary cairn, was built over which neither family dared cross, lest it be interpreted as a declaration of war. So Jacob has Laban behind him, and then news comes that Esau, his brother, is coming to meet him with 400 armed men. Laban behind, Esau in front, but Jacob still schemes and plans, and he has a scheme for self-preservation, and wave after wave of presents is sent towards Esau to try and buy him off and cool his anger. And it's at this juncture that we take up the narrative. Verse 22. That night Jacob got up and took his two wives, his two maidservants, his 11 sons, and he crossed the ford of the Jabbok River. After he had sent them across the stream, he sent over all his possessions. So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip, so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The man said to him, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he answered. Then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with men and have overcome." Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the tendon attached to the socket of the hip, because the socket of Jacob's hip was touched near the tendon. Amen, and may God add his blessing to this public reading of his most holy word. You will find it helpful to turn to the passage we read together earlier. There are a great many ways of unpacking this great portion of the book of Genesis. In many ways, it's perhaps the best known passage concerning the life of Jacob. And I want us, as we consider what is truly the most important crisis in Jacob's life, I want us to try and examine the passage by reducing it to four verbs. And the verbs are these: Jacob trembling, Jacob wrestling, Jacob clinging, and Jacob limping. So if you bear that structure in mind, you'll have some idea of where we hope to go this evening. Try and hold on. You will remember that last week we commented upon the terror experienced by Jacob as he prepared to meet his brother Esau. This uneasiness and unsettledness of spirit seems to have prevented Jacob from sleeping. Was he perhaps still trembling with fear at the prospect of meeting the brother he had deceived some 20 years previously? Not just meeting his brother, but meeting the 400 armed men who were coming with him. Surely Jacob had taken every possible precaution. Would his plan for the protection of his family work as he hoped? We read in verse 22 that he got up in the middle of the night. He sent his family and his possessions across the Jabbok River while he remained alone on sentry duty. He clearly anticipated the possibility of a night attack. In his planning and in his scheming, Jacob had attempted to cover every possible contingency. And as a result of this latest move, he had left himself completely and absolutely alone. You may remember that the last time we read of Jacob being alone in this way and he being conscious of that sense of aloneness had been at Bethel 20 years previously, when God had first revealed himself to him. And he discovered at that time, you will remember, that a person's aloneness is often the very opportunity which God takes to meet with them. You see, there are some battles which require to be fought alone. There are times when no other living person can do a thing to help us. And this was such a time in Jacob's life. Again, as we pointed out last week, the one thing which separated Jacob from the richness of God's blessing and his usefulness in God's service was Jacob himself. Jacob's trouble was himself. His greatest danger was not Laban. His greatest danger was not Esau. His greatest danger was himself. His stubborn self-will and his oozing self-confidence. And to be alone with God was to prove to be the turning point in this man's life. Being alone with God is often the only way we have of arriving at a true knowledge of ourselves and of our ways. Devoid of all human comfort and distraction, we are open to what God would say to us. And there are many biblical examples of how God works with men when they are alone. Think of Moses alone with God in the desert for 40 years before being called to lead Israel out of Egypt. Or think of the aloneness experienced by David at Ziklag, when outlaw that he was at the time, was abandoned by his men. That sense of aloneness as they spoke of taking his life. Or think of the aloneness of Paul in the desert of Arabia, where he was 13 years, while God began to preach to him the gospel and to unfold its significance, that he might be a more effective communicator of that gospel. You see, God often does to us in solitude what he cannot do anywhere else. Bearing this in mind is the first thing which helps us to understand the significance of the great event before us. Here is Jacob, trembling, alone. But we read that while Jacob was standing guard, a hand reached out and grabbed him, and soon Jacob was wrestling for his life. Was it Esau? Was it one of Esau's men? Was it some hired assassin? Jacob would certainly, initially uncertain who this powerful foe might be. And yet he was no coward. Jacob engaged in this conflict with all his strength. You see, here we have a man who had succeeded in his eyes in all that he had hitherto sought to do. And he had no reason to think that he would fail at this juncture. Now you will notice that the text identifies Jacob's opponent in verse 24 as a man, while in verse 30, Jacob realizes that he has been wrestling with God. Hosea, the minor prophet, identifies the figure wrestling here with Jacob as the angel of the Lord. And most conservative scholars are agreed that this is a technical description for the pre-incarnational appearance of Christ. Jacob here, then, is wrestling with the second person of the Trinity. He is wrestling with the eternal Son of God. And the important thing for us to notice is that it was God who took the initiative. Now, this is a passage which is often mistakenly used to illustrate man's perseverance with God in prayer. But you see, Jacob did not initiate this wrestling bout. This is not Jacob coming to God and looking for God and praying to God. This is God looking for Jacob. This is God who has business with Jacob. The passage is teaching God's perseverance with his servant, and not the contrary. God's perseverance with his servant until he can break this man in order to remake him. And although this wrestling match was a physical contest, the physical struggle mirrored a spiritual struggle of far greater importance. And it is, you see, designed to give Jacob every opportunity to come to the end of himself, to say, I give up, I yield, I submit. God's aim is not merely to bring him to a place of physical submission, but to a place of spiritual submission. The purpose of this wrestling match was to let Jacob see what a poor, helpless, hopeless, worthless creature he really was, and to teach him that in recognizing his weakness, he would discover the source of his true strength. Paul records a similar experience in 2 Corinthians in chapter 12, and from the 9th verse. I'm sure you're familiar with this passage. On three occasions, Paul had prayed and asked God to remove from him some thorn in his flesh. We're not sure what it was, but whatever it was, it caused him great physical discomfort and great anguish of heart. And he cries to God to remove the thorn. And then he tells us what God replies. He said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. And commenting on God's reply, Paul says, therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest in me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in my weaknesses. I wonder this evening, have you ever had to wrestle with God? When you wanted to go your own way, when you had some scheme or plan you were determined to press through, when you thought you knew better than God how to do God's work, when you've sought to engage in that work in your own strength, I suspect that most of us have been there at one time or another. Many of us have been there on several occasions. And if that is the case, then you will surely be able to identify with at least two of the details which follow. First of all, you will notice the duration of this wrestling match. Verse 24, it lasted from dusk until daybreak. This is a mammoth wrestling bout. That is an inordinate length of time for a wrestling match. I'm told that most professional bouts today would last about a maximum of 20 minutes. And at the end of 20 minutes, many of the contestants are completely exhausted, perspiration flowing from them by the river load. But Jacob wrestles all night. He is determined that he will not yield. He is going to come out of this match the winner. Now, Jacob's determination is no greater than our frequent determination to have our own way and to seek to win against God. This is the essence of stubborn self-will. It refuses to yield. And this is one of the reasons why God must sometimes become our fierce antagonist, to overpower self within our hearts and to destroy sin's power. power there. The second interesting feature about this wrestling match is that it was Jacob's hip that was put out of joint when he wrestled. This was the extreme measure to which God had to resort because Jacob refused to yield. And I'm told that the hip joint is the strongest and the most powerful joint in all of the human frame. And that's what God touches here. You see, God always wins. And he always wins this kind of contest. And if we are smart, we'll recognize that early on and submit to him. Let me ask you this evening. Has God ever come and put your life out of joint? Has he ever come and touched some area of your life? Some personal financial setback? Some devastating, crippling loss? Some disturbing illness? Some great and grave disappointment? Of course, God sometimes has other purposes for all of these things, but they are often designed to weaken us in order that the source of our strength may be in him. We have seen Jacob trembling alone. We have commented on Jacob wrestling with God. And now, thirdly, in verse 26, we have a quite different picture. For Jacob is now clinging to the one who has triumphed over him. This is a different Jacob. What a change there is in the man. We hardly recognize him. Jacob's strength is completely broken, and he is simply clinging to Christ for blessing. He is no longer struggling for supremacy, but clinging for support. His opponent had wasted, as we said earlier, the strongest ligament in his body, and he knew it. He would be a cripple for the rest of his life. And more immediately, any tentative plans or hopes he may have harbored about overcoming Esau or running away from him are now completely dashed. How does Top Lady put it in his hymn? Helpless, look to thee for grace. That pictures Jacob here. Helpless, look to thee for grace. And yet this picture of Jacob clinging is not the picture of a weak, pathetic, broken, useless man. This is the picture of a man remade by God's grace and surrendered to God's will. It's really a picture of faith. And what makes this picture all the more remarkable is the realization on Jacob's part that God had come to him as his protagonist. It wasn't Esau who had been threatening him, but God himself who was against him. Now, at this point, Jacob could have said, listen, what kind of way is this for you to treat me? For I have sought to serve you and to fulfill your purposes. You told me to return to Canaan, and I've done precisely that. I'm giving up on you, God. I'm taking my family and my children and heading east, away from the land of Canaan and away from the purposes of God. He could have said that, but he doesn't. Why? His longing for the blessing of God was greater than any humiliation of his ego. No apparently harsh treatment on the part of God could turn his head. If God had dealt with him in this way, it was because it was necessary for God to do so. And there was only one thing left for Jacob to do, and that was to see that his help lay in God alone. Wesley captures this beautifully. He writes, "Other refuge have I none. Hangs my weary soul on thee. Leave me not alone. Still support and comfort me. All my trust in thee is stayed. All my help from thee I bring." Do you see the picture? Wesley clinging as Jacob clung. Jacob had made a marvelous discovery. The importance of hanging helpless on Christ. That's the picture. Hanging helpless on Christ. No more scheming, no more plotting, no more planning, no more self-confidence in his ability to extricate himself from this or that difficulty. His strength is now made perfect in weakness. And you will notice that the blessing Jacob sought was not cheaply secured, for in verse 27, the Lord asks him, "What is your name?" That's a strange question. Did Jacob's mind spring back to that occasion, 20 years previously, when he had entered his father's tent, disguised as his brother Esau, and his father had asked a similar question? "Who are you? Identify yourself before I give you my blessing." And on that occasion, Jacob had replied, "Esau." He had pretended to be something that he wasn't in order to gain the blessing he longed for. And by so doing had lived up to the significance of his name, Jacob, twister, cheat, supplanter, heel grasper. How often in the Old Testament do we find a person's name reflecting their true character? But now that self-same question is put to Jacob again. What is your name? Who are you? Who is it that seeks this blessing? And the God who asks that question cannot be deceived, as senile old Isaac had been deceived. This God sees right into our hearts. And you will notice that blessing comes not by hiding our true identity, but by exposing our true identity. And Jacob identifies himself, and by so doing, he was telling God more than his name. He was confessing more than his name. He was confessing a character. I am a cheat. I am a deceiver. I am a supplanter. He was owning up to being all of these things. God, you see, had forced him to confess his past. And by so doing, God was preparing him for a new future. A future which you'll notice was marked by a new name, Israel. A change of name which spoke of a change of heart. Now, commentators are not in general agreement over the meaning of the word Israel. It is a compound of two words, Serar, which means to struggle for supremacy, to rule, and El, which means God. And many commentators have taken this to mean he struggles with God. And this is certainly the way in which the translators of the New International Version have viewed the word, and you'll find that in the footnote. Now, for reasons which I won't go into at any great length this evening, there is another possibility. And I'm very grateful to James Montgomery Boyce at this point. And he suggests the translation of the name Israel should in fact be God rules. For as a result of the wrestling match with God, God, for the first time, began to exercise unhindered his rule in a now submissive and dependent heart. Now, this meaning of the word Israel would require us to read verse 28 as irony. Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with men and have overcome. You're the winner, you're the victor, because you're strong, you're a great wrestler, Jacob. It requires us to read that as irony. When Jacob had contended with men and thought he had succeeded, had he not really lost? He had cheated Esau of the blessing, but he had lost his way spiritually. He had outwitted his blind, ailing father, but he had lost his home comforts. He had deceived Laban, but had lost his uncle's goodwill. None of these blessings had brought him lasting satisfaction. In his latest confrontation, this time with God, he had suffered a reversal of fortunes. He had lost. But in losing, he had won. He had lost. But in losing, he had won. And that is the divine logic, you see, of his circumstances. I wonder if we have grasped that divine logic in our own lives. We win by losing. George Muller was a remarkable Christian who lived in Bristol at the turn of the century. And he built a number of children's homes for orphans, on which Bernardo's and Quarrier's homes were to be modeled. And he made no public appeal for finance or for help. But over a period of time, George Muller was responsible for praying in something like £2 million. Not in today's money. This is at the turn of the century, so you can get your calculators out and work out what's that worth with inflation and so on. George Muller was once asked, "What is the secret of your extraordinary life?" And he gave a simple six-word answer. He said, "There was a day George Muller died." There was a day George Muller died. We win by losing. We die to self. to self-will, to self-confidence. We let go of that, and we win. What did Jesus say? Unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it produces much fruit. The man who loves his life will lose it, while the man who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. Dying to self, letting go, and winning with God. I wonder if we are able to look over our lives and see what it has cost us to continue with God. I wonder, are there wounds that we proudly wear? Are there deaths that we have died? Surrenders that we have made, we sung earlier, or at least Julia played for us during the offering. I surrender all. All to Jesus I surrender. I surrender all. I can remember being challenged many years ago by these words of Amy Carmichael, and I've mentioned her to you before. She's one of my favorite writers. Here is her poem. Hast thou no scar, no hidden scar on foot or side or hand? I hear thee sung as mighty in the land. I hear them hail thy bright ascending star. Hast thou no scar? Hast thou no wound? Yet I was wounded by the archer spent, leaned me against the tree to die and rent, by ravening beasts that compassed me, I swooned. Hast thou no wound? No wound, no scar. Yet as the master shall the servant be, and pierced are the feet that followed thee, but thine are whole. Can he have followed far who has no wound, no scar? We have seen Jacob trembling alone, wrestling through the night, clinging on to Jesus for his blessing. The final picture we have is of him limping on his way to meet Esau. There is a very wonderful picture here in verse 33. We're told that he left as the sun was rising. The new day marked a new beginning for a new man. You see, in the world's eyes, he was a cripple. But in God's sight, he was a man who had become an overcomer through defeat. He is no longer striding confidently through life, but now wholly dependent on God as his helper and his staff as the symbol of that. I need help to make my way through this pilgrimage in this earth. His wound he would carry with him all the way through his life. It was a constant reminder of that crisis in his life, of that day when Jacob died, of that day when God touched him. The writer to the Hebrews provides us with a wonderful comment on the significance of that day. In Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 21 we read, "By faith when he was dying, Jacob blessed each of Joseph's sons and worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff." Do you see the significance of that? This was the staff which reminded Jacob of the day when God touched him, of the day when he submitted to God, of the day when he died, of the day when he knew complete submission to the mind and to the will of God. And it was as he grasped all of that and saw what God had accomplished in consequence of that he worshipped the God who had crippled him. It was worth it, you see. God had touched him, but in touching him had made him a new man. And he would carry that wound all through eternity. I wonder if you are familiar with Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. If you are, you may well remember the occasion towards the end of the first book when Mr. Valiant for the Truth was preparing to leave this life and enter the celestial city, and he spoke these very remarkable words. "Then he said, I am going to my father, and though with great difficulty I am going hither, yet now I do not repent me of all the trouble I have been to arrive where I am. My sword I give to him who shall succeed me in my pilgrimage, and my courage and skill to him who can get it. My marks and scars I carry with me, to be a witness for me that I have fought his battles, who now will be my rewarder." Do you see what Mr. Valiant for the Truth is saying? Yes, I've got scars. Yes, I know the mark of the cross on my life, but I'm not giving that up. I'm carrying these scars with me all the way into eternity to meet my rewarder. I wonder, is God wrestling with someone here this evening? Perhaps someone who has resisted the will of God for weeks or months, or perhaps even for years. Has he begun to touch some area of your life with this very purpose in mind, to bring you to an end of yourself, to that place where you cling to Christ in submission to his will? When God works in this way, he does so not to destroy us. If he seems to be our antagonist, it is not to destroy us, but to equip us, to make us fruitful in his service, cause us to know the richness of his blessing,